As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Real quick before we get started, we just wanted to thank Jason Lee for carving out the time to hang out with us and geek out about film photography and give some great answers and just to hear, you know, his story and all that stuff. We were super excited to get him on the show and, you know, definitely the number one fan requested guest that we've had to bring on the show. So Jason, thanks so much. And yeah. Here you go, guys. Here's the show. Hey, guys. Welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And today on the show, we have Mr. Jason Lee.
Hey, Jason.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I will tell you that you're our most requested guest.
For sure.
By far. Yeah. So we're excited to have you on. For our listeners who may not know you, can you kind of give us a background on yourself and how you got into photography and all that?
Well, in the early skateboarding days in the 90s, I was using a lot of Super 8 film for the stereo skateboards videos that we were making. And so I was definitely interested in film as early as, I would say, 93, 94. I was around a lot of skateboard photographers, of course, mm-hmm. but I was just kind of so focused on skateboarding and on making the videos that I hadn't yet really taken an interest in photography. And then after skateboarding, I got into acting, and it was basically through that I sort of, in a way, remembered that I used to use a lot of Super 8 film mm-hmm. And I was working on a film in 2002 and kind of just one day I, you know, because actors kind of do their thing and then the crew, they kind of do their thing and mm-hmm. actors are busy kind of memorizing their dialogue and being directed. And there's usually a pretty big gap between sort of the world of the actor and the world of the camera department.
Yeah.
So just kind of one day on this set. 17 years ago now, I kind of just looked at the big Panavision camera and it all just, it just became interesting to me. I don't really know why exactly or what was this, what the spark was in that moment. But, and then I just started talking with the camera guys, like what kind of film are you using? in the early stereo days, I was shooting a lot of Super 8 film is it the same kind of film? And what are all these lights? And mm-hmm. and then I just kind of went from there. And I bought a Bolex 16 millimeter camera, a Mamiya RZ67, and a Leica M6. And I basically just started picking the brains of these camera guys and dove headfirst into it, started taking notes, experimenting with pushing and pulling different film types and experimenting with lighting and color temperature. And I'd heard for the first time things like 18% gray.
Yep.
And I bought a spot meter and I went to New Mexico and studied with Alan Ross for a minute. He, I think to this day, still prints the Ansel Adams negatives.
Oh, wow.
So that was probably like 2002 or 3 maybe. So basically right after that film shoot, I would go back to my hotel room and I would take the cameras out and I would shoot. I had the Bolex on a tripod and I was shooting with the Mamiya RZ67. And then I found out about this guy, Alan Ross, and he did classes in his dark room, and he'd go out. And of course you would use your spot meter and you would expose for the shadows. And then you would, burn and dodge and do all the printing in the dark room. And I did that with him. And then from there, I kind of just kept taking notes and experimenting and learning everything I could about film. I've basically been hooked ever since.
That's the best.
Sorry for keeping making that so long. I tried to keep it short, but that's basically the gist of how it kind of started for me.
Now, have you ever, because around that time, 2002, 2003, that's mm-hmm. when I went to photography school, and we were basically still in the dark room and still shooting mm-hmm. a film, but then like right after that is when like the digital craze mm-hmm. kind of took over. Did you ever pick up a digital camera along the way, or have you always been strictly film?
Only film.
Nice.
Yeah, only film. I didn't really think that the two were similar, or I just didn't really think about it. That's all I've ever known is film. And so I don't really give too much thought to sort of new technology. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think that just because something is new, it's better.
True.
And film has always just sort of been synonymous with photography, just for me personally. And I tend to appreciate people that still use film and filmmakers that still use film for their movies. There's just, the difference is just very, very noticeable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never got into the digital thing.
Man, so when you were shooting the Bolex, was that just like home movies, or were you out like shooting something specific with that?
It was really just to experiment. So, I was learning about neutral density filters, and I was learning about, I've got this Kodak Vision stock, it's 500 tungsten. So I need an 85 filter if I'm going to shoot it outside, which brings it down to ISO 320. Sometimes, we'd do night shoots and then I'd come back early in the morning and mm-hmm. I'd be tired, but I'd want to burn some film. And so I would put the Bolex on a tripod and I would do a time lapse of the sun coming up.
Oh, cool.
With the long of the city below. This would have been Vancouver, Canada. And shooting, with the Polaroid back on the RZ67, exposing a ton of sheets of Polaroid film. And that, we can talk about that too, but that's where my interest in Polaroid film came about. A lot of it had to do with just kind of the excitement of having these cameras and wanting to learn as much as I could. And so it was always nice to get those instant results with the Polaroid film, but then I ended up falling in love with the tones of the black and white Polaroid pack films. So yeah, it was just a time of, the way I discovered skateboarding. Once I clicked in, I never stopped. Same with photography. Mm-hmm. Once I clicked into it and realized that, this is something that you can practice, learn about, gain knowledge about, and hopefully get better at doing. Just like with skateboarding and acting, it became sort of the next thing for me. And so I became very sort of studious about it, and I'm an avid note taker, and this was kind of, I don't know if the internet was really, I think there would be chat message boards that sometimes ask questions on, or look at books and read and just kind of gain as much knowledge as I could. And then of course you abandon all that,
right?
Which I did. I had a studio in downtown LA.
Ugh.
And this was when rent there was very cheap still.
The dream, yeah.
And, you know, of course, I bought naturally, as I should have, having sort of that, having had that spark kind of hit on a movie set and wanting to learn about lighting and these other characteristics. I bought lights. I bought strobes. I bought Aeroflex hot lights and with barn doors and gels and scrims, and you know, so I was shooting in window light, I was shooting with strobe light, with soft boxes, and you know, just almost daily and nightly for a while. And then my first road trip with my 8x10 camera in 2006, once I was out on the road and kind of felt for the first time that that's where I belonged, when I got back from that first road trip in 2006, I basically had a garage sale in my loft and
got rid of it all.
Sold, and
wow.
I sold all my lights and light stands, and I kept the Aeroflex hot light set for shooting motion picture film. Yeah. I kept the movie lights, but everything else I got rid of, and I've kind of been an exterior kind of out on the road photographer ever since.
Man, I feel like we all kind of go through that phase, though, of like doing strobes and lights. I mean, I feel like it's a part of the game, you know, like you kind of have
figuring
to learn
out your style.
You learn so much about light when you play with light. So I think it's a big part. But yeah, I kind of did the same thing. Bought all the lights and then sold all the lights after I went through that phase.
That's funny. I mean, that's great. I mean, you know, there's a lot of obviously really talented portrait photographers and studio photographers out there. It was a necessary thing for me. And of course, I learned a great deal. And then of course, after that, I was really tuned in on all future work that I would do as an actor.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I knew about depth of field. Mm-hmm. I knew about, you know, focal lengths, and I knew all about the lighting, and so I, and then as an actor, strangely, it sort of felt like, It gave me a unique sort of sense of confidence, just in terms of feeling connected and sort of complete as a performer.
Yeah, yeah.
Being on sets when I understand exactly what's going on, you know, the axis and eye lines, and the wider the lens, the tighter the eye line has to be to the lens. Otherwise, it looks like you're looking way off camera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not connected to the actor's eyes who's standing off camera, and you know, as camera angles move and these things. So yeah, it was good that I understood all of that stuff. It was very, very beneficial to me. And then, you know, and then I kind of let all of that go and have been using natural light ever since, with the exception of some music videos I've shot with the Bolex where I've used the movie lights. But other than that, it's kind of been outside for the last 13 years.
That's great. That gives you kind of a creative advantage, being an actor too, kind of knowing where everything is.
Mm-hmm.
On set. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
That's cool.
Do you direct at all, Jason?
That's something I'd like to get more into. But yeah, I mean, I made a short film in 2006, and I've directed some music videos and some documentaries and a lot of 16 millimeter stuff. Yeah, little bits and pieces of things here and there, but yeah, I certainly love it. It's really no different than photography in some ways, you know.
Yeah, man, we got to talk about your Polaroid phase.
Oh yeah.
What drew you to shooting? I mean, we know Polaroid kind of vanished, and then Fuji kind of took over on that end, and then they're kind of gone now. So how did you get into the peel apart stuff?
Well, like I had said, you know, I had the Mamiya RZ67 when I was up in Canada. I bought it from a camera store. It's so depressing how cheap those cameras are these days. I paid so much for my RZ kit with the grip and the Polaroid back and the lenses. And anyway, like I had said, I was shooting a lot of the Polaroid pack film with the RZ. And I absolutely loved the I think it would have been the 604, the 100 speed. really kind of charcoal-like, beautiful gray tones. Mm-hmm. I was blown away by the film. And I had learned that a lot of, you know, people were using that film to sort of, you know, pre-digital to sort of test their kind of studio conditions. And then they would put the conventional film magazines on the back and then shoot the quote unquote real photos.
Yep. Which is crazy to think about, that it was just kind of like a throwaway.
Yeah, it was a test shot.
Lighting. Yeah, I was interested in the Polaroid stuff. I thought this is just the most beautiful black and white tones I'd ever seen. And then I discovered that Polaroid made that film in 8x10. So of course, immediately I go online and I buy an 8x10 camera. It's an old kind of beat up 1930s Century Universal, and it had on it two 10 millimeter wide field Wallensack lens. And I went to Sammy's Camera on Fairfax. Sammy's is now in Pasadena. And I just started buying 8x10 Polaroid film with some of that acting money because it's not cheap.
Wow.
You know, for 15 exposures, it was like 100 and something bucks a box.
Oh, geez. Man.
And so I started with all the lighting and stuff when I still had that space in LA. I was exposing 8x10 Polaroid film with, you know, window light, strobe light, hot light, whatever, portraits, really experimenting with this film. And, you know, of course, when I peeled that very first 8x10 black and white Polaroid,
I can only imagine.
I was absolutely mesmerized. It was stunning. And so a little bit of experimenting here and there. I would bring the 8x10 camera with me to the set of My Name is Earl from time to time. And I shot photos of Ethan Suplee, who played my brother on the show.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And those ran in a magazine called Anthem. So I was, you know, I was doing a lot of this sort of kind of portrait stuff. And then I think just one day I had the idea to bring the 8x10 camera with me out on the road. I didn't know of anybody that was exposing 8x10 Polaroid film outside of a studio setting.
Right. Yeah.
I had the plug-in processor because, you know, it's two separate sheets.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you put the negative in the film holder and then the positive goes in the processor, and then the two are joined by a tab. And they go through the rollers and then you peel them and you get your print. So I thought, well, what do I do for a processor? So I found out that Calumet made a hand crank field processor, right? So I bought one of those. And those now, believe it or not, on eBay sell for upwards of $1,200.
Ooh.
Yeah, yeah, they do. Yep.
And so I had an SUV at the time. I put a clothesline in the back. I probably had about six boxes of 8x10 Polaroid film, black and white and color. My old Century Universal with my tripod, my loop, a dark cloth, and a light meter, and my Sharpie. And I just kind of started driving around California.
Amazing.
And when I started seeing those 8x10 Polaroid prints out in the wild, I was absolutely ecstatic. It was so exciting to know that I was making these instant 8x10 prints on the side of the road.
Yeah. That's crazy.
It was really, really incredible. And then I did another road trip with that camera and more of those films in 2007. And then kind of abandoned that. And then I basically went 35 millimeter and 120 black and white films for the next many, many years out on the road. And happily and sadly at the same time, I still have about 20 something boxes of 8x10 Polaroid film.
Yeah, I was just going to ask.
I say that the happy part is that I have them. The sad part is that most of the black and white chemicals have dried up. The color stuff holds longer, but it gets really streaky and it color shifts. But the black and white stuff crystallizes.
Dang.
But I've got those boxes anyway. And in 2016, I went out on the road for the first time with the Polaroid films. I did a little road trip, Texas, and I went to Arkansas and with a filmmaker friend of mine named Greg Hunt. And he documented the struggle of me trying to find good exposures with my old 8x10 Polaroid film. And so we want to kind of complete this movie. Basically, I want to take every last box that I have, whether it's good, bad, or somewhere in the middle, and hit the road and expose every last sheet of it.
Oh, that's
and see what I get, whether it's full or partial chemical spreads on the print. And we want to kind of finish this little documentary about about the trials and tribulations and hopefully joys of me getting through my last boxes of the big Polaroid films.
Oh man.
So sometime relatively soon we'll try to complete that project. But I wanna expose the last box, or at least the last sheet, in California somewhere, because that's where it all started.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I love that. Love it.
That's the thing about saving all those, but like I have some, you know, Fuji pill apart that I'm just like saving, and it doesn't do any good in the fridge. Like I just gotta go shoot it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know what I mean? Cause it's gone.
It's, I have, maybe 10 boxes of 3000 B. I have a few boxes of 100 C. I've got a few boxes of 4x5 100 C, but it's yellow. Mm. My pack. The 3¼ by 4¼ 100 C, that's all yellow, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of a sad thing.
It is.
Technology tends to, you know, kind of wipe lots of things out in its wake, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I hope in the future, like, society will realize that there's things we need to save and hold on to and not just like move on with, I don't know. It's like really sad.
It's tough. Yeah, it is. It's tough. I guess the reasoning is that there wasn't enough demand. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but it was it was fun while it
That's
lasted.
True.
And we'll see what I can get from these remaining boxes of the Polaroid films that I have.
That's funny.
Yeah, we can't wait to see how it comes out.
Yeah, we'll see. With the same camera, by the way.
Yes.
Wow.
I still have that old Century Universal that I paid $400 for on eBay.
So you put together, didn't you do like a little book project with your Polaroids too? Wasn't that?
Yeah, well, shortly after I moved to Texas, Chris Brown from Refueled Magazine, kind of creative magazine, he reached out to me and said, "Let's do something with your photography." And I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I'm super flattered. Let's do it." And we were going to do a volume one instant film and a volume two conventional film. And we just never got around to doing volume two. So there's a hardcover 500 print edition of a Refueled issue, essentially, that has a bunch of the Polaroid stuff in it from 2006 to 2016, including quite a bit of the original 8x10s. Mm.
Those are all gone, right? Aren't the books?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. Can we still get them?
Yeah.
Yeah, those sold out.
Yeah, that's what
Dang.
I thought.
When they came out. But I'm going to, you know, at some, you know, what I'm going to do is hopefully we get somewhat of a little documentary from Greg, who's just a great filmmaker.
Oh, yeah, he's the best.
And I want to do a book where maybe, you know, the first half of the book is all the original 8x10 Polaroids, and then the second half of the book is from all the expired Polaroids.
That'll be cool.
Polaroids, and kind of section out the book in that way, you know, revisiting a dying medium.
Yeah.
Here are the results, good, bad, and ugly. And at the beginning of the book, sort of here's what the film used to look like when you could buy it off the shelf at a camera store.
Wow.
So that's probably within the next 3 or 4 years, we'll get that done realistically.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great plan. I love that. Because, you know, we, just like Chris said, we all have boxes of this stuff sitting on our fridge, you know, not getting.
Yeah, we covet it. It's so depressing.
Yeah. It is. And I just scored a couple boxes of the old.
You did. That's
Polaroid.
Right.
Well, the 3000B and some Polaroid 669 that works. It's that like weird purpley looking. I haven't been sharing anything yet, but it's a really cool, like, abstract look because it's so aged and dated. It doesn't definitely pull like it used to, but it, you know, it's still neat. It's still neat to use. And
it is still neat. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It goes through those shifts.
Do you shoot any Polaroid originals? Impossible Polaroid originals?
Like the Time Zero stuff?
No, just the
new
What Was Impossible project
is
now
branded
Polaroid
stuff.
Originals.
Yeah, that's like the old Time Zero stuff. I never really had an SX-70 and I've exposed a few sheets of that film, but I didn't really care for the Mylar the really sheeny kind of shiny kind of plastic coating. Mm. I like the sort of muted kind of matte quality of the peel apart, the print side of the peel apart film more than the sort of Mylar spit out film, you know?
Yeah. I never really thought of it that way. It is very shiny. It is like a pearl, a pearl sheen to it every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's great that somebody's doing something to keep some of that going, obviously, you know?
Yeah. We're hoping that Doc, who did the Impossible Project, will be able to save peel apart.
Yeah, geez. I guess Fuji would not give them the machine.
Isn't that crazy? Like, what? Why? Like, why would you not? I'm still mad. Sorry. Don't let me get don't let me go off on a tangent.
Yeah, 3000B is really, really was really nice.
Oh, it's but beautiful.
The Polaroid 604 and then the Polaroid 804, the 8x10 version of it, just unbelievable film. I'm so glad I had the good fortune of stumbling upon the large Polaroid films when I did. It's just such a special medium.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever do a show, or would you consider doing like a show along with the book if you ever?
Yeah, that would be the idea too, is to kind of show the original Polaroids. I've only ever shown one of the original Polaroids at a gallery in Los Angeles, and it got stolen.
No
way.
I don't know if you know the Dennis Hopper Polaroid story.
No, what happened?
I didn't know it got stolen. Is that recent? Was that not too long ago?
No, this was years ago. This was like 2010. Jeremy and Claire Weiss, sweet, sweet couple, great photographers. They had a really cool little gallery in LA, and there was a group show and with 50 some odd photographers.
Yeah.
And you show one piece each, everything framed in white frames, and just like a big sort of salon style kind of exhibition. I was out of town, ironically, in Vancouver, filming a movie. And I decided that I was going to show I had the good fortune of being able to shoot a portrait on 8x10 Polaroid film of Dennis Hopper for Anthem magazine with the 804 film, that beautiful gray Polaroid film at his house in Venice Beach. It took me about 7 exposures. And of course, I rip up the ones I don't like so that the one that you get is the only one. It's a one-off. And so I finally got the one that I wanted, and Mr. Hopper seemed to be pleased with it. And I was very happy with it. And we scanned it, and it ran in Anthem magazine. And so I framed that and I hung it at the gallery for this group show. And I get a call up in Vancouver that sadly, at the end of the night, as the gallery was closing, somebody ran up to the wall and grabbed it and ran down the street.
No way.
That is so, first of all, so ballsy.
Oh, man. So I had thought maybe I'll scan it and do like a print, an actual size print, and I'll show the original Polaroid. That might be kind of cool.
Oh my God.
After 2+ years, it was finally tracked down.
You got it back?
I got it back.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it's a portrait of Dennis Hopper.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily hugely important. It might not even be the greatest of portraits. But for me, it meant something very personal to me. And technically speaking, it's the only 8x10 Polaroid of Dennis Hopper ever to exist. And so it was naturally very relieving and somewhat emotional when we got it back.
Man.
And it was unscathed, and it was okay, and everything like that. And
did it show up in a gallery somewhere? And somebody was like, "Wait a minute."
Well, we had a group of people that were willing to help us kind of try to find some people that maybe knew some people that maybe knew some people. And then over time, it was eventually sent back anonymously to the gallery from which it was stolen.
Wow. What a story, man.
Yeah, really.
Anyway, so to go back to your question, I think we are sort of planning on showing some of the original Polaroids from then and from the newer stuff.
Just make sure you have like an alarm system like around.
A little chain
attached
to it. Go past
the line, it starts beeping.
So if anybody's listening who would like to steal more 8x10 Polaroids, we'll be showing more in the future.
Oh, man.
At a location as yet not yet determined.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
Jeez.
Man.
That's crazy. So you have an exhibition going on right now, don't you? Don't you have a show or something going on?
Yeah, up in Tulsa, yeah.
Tulsa, okay.
At Philbrook Museum. Photos that I made in Oklahoma last year and a project that's been going on in the works for a year now. And we had two openings over the last two weekends, and now I'm kind of home just kind of decompressing after all that work.
Man, yeah, I couldn't imagine putting on like a big show like that. Like just picking where the photos go would drive me nuts. I would be like, nope, not good enough, this one needs to go.
Yeah, it was a lot of trips up to the museum and getting the schematics and the blueprints and the dimensions, and spending about 3 or 4 months with thumbnails laying out the exhibition based on the space, and then determining what prints would go with what and what sizes everything would be printed at and how we would frame everything and pair prints together and create grids. And it's 178 prints.
Wow.
And it occupies about 3,000 square feet of museum space. And
man, that's awesome.
Very particular spacing between the frames. And so, yeah, it was my first time really kind of having to dive in and kind of design something over the course of many months. And it turned out pretty well. And we were all pleased. And so that's up through November at Philbrook. Tulsa is booming artistically right now. Philbrook is such a great institution. They're very supportive of artists. They have their main museum, which is an old villa in Tulsa, and then they have their sort of contemporary museum in downtown Tulsa in the Arts District, and that's where my photos are hanging. And then in the adjacent gallery in their downtown museum are some of the original Larry Clark Tulsa prints.
Okay. That's like one of my favorite series. Larry's the best.
Yeah, the museum acquired a portfolio of prints, I think, from the 70s from that series of his. So you've got sort of all my exterior kind of roadside Oklahoma. And then in the gallery next to mine, you've got Larry Clark's black and white Tulsa prints.
Yeah.
So those shows are going through November, I believe.
November. Okay. Good to know. I need a little road trip. I need a little road trip in my life. Maybe.
Tulsa's great. It's really great. They have they're putting a lot of money into the arts, and they have a big artist fellowship there, and there's always pop-up exhibitions and the city is doing interesting things right now for the arts, and happy to be a part of it.
Man, it's great.
I love hearing that. I feel like that's happening a lot at a lot of different places, you know, like they're really building up the arts in Nashville and stuff like that. I know, like even where there's a big art scene and you're in Denton, or is that where you're
at? I'm near Denton, Texas. Yeah, definitely.
Man.
A lot of music, a lot of art here. It's a little easier to accomplish when the place feels a little bit smaller.
Yeah.
Tulsa's a great example of a city that feels like a big town.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so we'd go out to dinner, and there would be artists sitting at the table, members of the artist fellowship with studios sort of given to them by the fellowship. And,
man, that's great.
You know, and you're just talking about creativity and, and it's everybody feels a little connected in a place that doesn't feel that's relatively big, but feels at heart kind of small. You feel this sense of connection and community. So Tulsa is a great example of that sense of artistic community that's happening.
Man, that's great.
In places like that. Yeah.
I feel like we all need that. It really makes things a whole lot different. Cause I mean, I couldn't imagine like the area. I used to live up north in the east in Pennsylvania, like central Pennsylvania, and the arts are not an importance of anything there. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't imagine still being stuck there doing what I do now, just like, I mean, it would be great to shoot because the, the locations are great. Pennsylvania's beautiful, but just showing
even with Warhol up there, like there's not a Warhol foundation.
That's like Western Pennsylvania, you know, closer to Pittsburgh and stuff. Okay. So I'm like more so close to like Philadelphia. I mean, there's don't get me wrong. There's a huge scene in Philadelphia, but there's also a lot of, you know, bad stuff going on as well. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of I feel like towns that do more for the art community aren't as impoverished and grumpy and, you know, just like, you know, it's not as like the East Coast is already like mad to begin with. So it's,
I didn't realize that.
Well, it's always that, you know, cold winters and you only get, especially like growing up as a skateboarder too. Like I used to skate when I was in my teens and 20s and stuff. And, you know, you'd skate in the middle of winter and it was terrible. So you'd just be pissed off in Philadelphia, like skating, getting arrested and not having the best time because you only have summer like 3 months out of the year. But yeah. But yeah,
it's hard to skate when it's that cold. That's for sure.
But I mean, you'd be surprised with the amount of dedication in the cold and East Coast that there is.
So many legendary skaters have come from the East Coast. So they braved the storm and got through, and we're thankful for that.
For sure, man. So what are you working on now? What are you still doing the road trip stuff all the time, or?
Well, Oklahoma was basically off and on road trips through June and November of last year, and then in November I started laying out the exhibition, and that took a while. Simultaneously, I was slowly starting to kind of lay out the book.
I was going to ask if there was a book to go along with it.
Yeah. and then, you know, getting the exhibition together took from November through May.
Wow.
And now that everything's hanging and it's all there, I'm kind of just relaxing for a few
days. Taking a little break.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then working on the book, the Oklahoma book, which hopefully end of the year or early spring. Books are really, really hard to make.
Yeah.
It's a long process.
Are you working with a publisher on that, or is it?
That'll be independently published as the under the Film Photographic name.
Yeah.
This one in collaboration with the museum, of course. That'll take a good kind of 6 months to get that done. So that's sort of the next thing that I'm working on. And then a publisher in the UK called Stanley Barker. They do some really beautiful photo books.
I've heard that name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've done some really, really nice books. They've shown interest in wanting to publish a book of black and white photos from my archives.
Oh, cool.
Ooh,
so we're hoping to release that sometime in 2020. Mm. And then I think in 2021, we want to issue a second printing of a Plain View, which is the Texas book that I did last year. So there's a few books kind of on the horizon, but certainly I get hungry for shooting photos. So I'll find time to go out on the road whenever I can over the coming months throughout all this book work. And I think it'll be necessary to take those breaks. And
Yeah.
Because burnout is a real thing. Burnout can definitely happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of technical stuff that goes into laying out a show or working on a book. And, you know, and so when you get, for me personally, just like with skating, you know, when you get back on the board or you get back on the road and you're exposing film again, that very unique sense of excitement kind of returns to you. And so these coming months of working on these book projects, I'm definitely going to find time to get out on the road. And I think, but in terms of a sort of place that I'm interested in, to go and kind of spend time off and on, as I did up in Oklahoma and before that in Texas, I would be Louisiana.
Oh yeah.
I'm interested in going to New Orleans, which I've spent many, many months in over the years working on various projects as an actor, but then also seeing Louisiana.
Yeah, I was just there. I was in New Orleans in September and I was blown away. There, talk about an art scene.
New Orleans, there's no city like it in the country.
It's incredible.
But I also want to see Louisiana. Though.
Right, right,
You
right.
know what I mean? I don't want to do something just on New Orleans. You know, it's a part of Louisiana just as Tulsa is a part of Oklahoma.
Right.
But, you know, spending 2 weeks in Tulsa and then going, you know, hundreds of miles northeast and northwest of Tulsa and kind of all around the state, you're really able to create a big broad picture and real contrast between the sort of booming parts of a state and the not so booming parts of a state. And when you think of Louisiana, you think of New Orleans, and you want to show New Orleans, but you also want to show what else is out there. And that's what interests me. And so for whatever reason, I've been sort of thinking about Louisiana as a place to kind of roam around and shoot some photos.
So how does that work? Do you, when you do these trips, do you drive like all the way there and then drive through the state? Or do you kind of just like fly in and then rent a car and do your thing? Or do you have like a specific way of doing
this? No, I drive my own car.
Yeah.
Oklahoma is only about an hour from here.
I keep forgetting you're in Texas. I don't know why I think you're just in California all the time.
So, okay, guys, I'm going to leave for a week and go aimlessly drive around Oklahoma, expose a bunch of film and stay in hotels, motels, wherever I can stay. And you know, I feel like I want to go home now, go home for a few weeks, a month, 2 weeks, a week, whatever, send film off to the labs, and then, you know, kind of get back up there. And just, it's all very spontaneous and just kind of played by ear. And that's what it was in Texas and then Oklahoma after that. But when I lived in California and I would do Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado loops, that was obviously, those were trips obviously where I'd be gone for longer periods of time because I was reaching out pretty far going to Texas. And I've done that a few times over the years, and a lot of California and the Pacific Northwest, and a lot of that black and white stuff, I think, is what we'll pull from for the Stanley Barker book.
It's just being able to, you know, go and drive.
Oh,
and
it's the best. It's absolutely the best. Yeah.
Yeah, I need that. I need that soon.
We all need that.
Yeah, it's good to go out and see things.
Yeah.
And drive. And,
for sure.
You know.
I drove across the country and I moved to L.A. And, you know, I was trying to get to L.A. because I was so excited to be moving here. So, and I had a friend, luckily, who was like, we're going to slow down. We're going to go to the Grand Canyon. We're going to stop in Arizona, like all these places. And I shot a bunch of photos, and I'm very thankful that I did, because America's really beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very strange, beautifully strange country, for sure. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you did that. Yeah, I can't drive. Yeah, I drive to L.A., here and there, and I have to have cameras on me.
Right.
You know? Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And it's always nice to, in a way that sort of Christenberry, you know, William Christenberry in Hale County, Alabama, for many decades, he'd revisit Hale County, Alabama. And, you know, over the course of many years, he would photograph a lot of the, you know, structures or some of the structures that he had photographed before, and you see the de-evolution of them over time, and just the idea of revisiting. So a lot of these photos that I've, you know, I have photos in towns and maybe even on streets, and in some cases, even the same structure or scene that I've captured 10 years ago.
Wow.
Kind of driving kind of back and forth between California and this part of America. And Seligman, Arizona, I always stop through there and eat at Westside Lilo's Cafe, which is amazing food. And, you know, it's always nice to kind of stop into these places that you're familiar with. And you see the old gas station in Seligman with its sort of mid-century big kind of winged lights and I've photographed it totally trimmed, and I've photographed it completely overgrown. And it's always nice to kind of pop in at these little spots that you've seen kind of here and there over the years and see how they've changed. And so, yeah, the road experience is always really kind of important to me.
I love that. There's so much to see too. There's just so much out there. Man, well, real quick, before we hop into the listener question stuff, you mentioned film photographic, like definitely a fan of film photographic. And what is that for our listeners that don't know what that is?
Well, I didn't really know what Instagram was, and then I found out, and then I wasn't into it. I was an Instagram holdout for a long time, just as I was an iPhone holdout. You know, I had a BlackBerry, and I refused to get an iPhone when they came out. And then, you know, I started looking around at what I learned were called hashtags, and I discovered that there were millions of film-related posts on Instagram.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's cool. I guess it's not just photos of people's cats and food, as I had heard it sort of was.
Mm-hmm.
There was a big film community on Instagram, and film photographic was always something that I'd wanted to do in website form and eventually publish. And then I just kind of laid it into Instagram. And that was 2015. And some friends, Vanessa Green from New Zealand, she's one of our curators, Jay Ravel from Tokyo. He's an old Canadian skateboarder, writer, film shooter, Eric Bouvet and Raymond Molinar in LA. We all kind of bounce around and kind of post at Film Photographic. We used to do more guest curators. Mm. I want to do a little bit more of that. That was always fun to do. But basically, we just post people's film photos.
Yeah,
I guess it's like a Instagram film community account, you know? That's been a fun outlet and a way to meet lots of people.
Because it's cool. You can follow hashtags now. That wasn't a thing a while back.
Yeah. But
I've always been a fan of the Film Photographic. There's always just great work. You guys always share a bunch of really good stuff. And, you know, I always tag my stuff as that as well. So it's kind
of... Oh, I'm sorry. I will have a look.
No worries. No, that's not why I said it. But
No, it's definitely been fun. It's sometimes a little hard to keep up with.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
But we've got, you know, a good group of people. And like I said, we've had some great guest curators. And I'd like to do more publishing with it. But I just never find the time. I've been really wanting to do these kind of annuals.
Yeah.
See, that would be so cool.
Where you take,
cool.
you know, 50 yeah. photographers 1 year and you put some of their work in, and then the next year you take another 50 or whatever it is. You know, you're doing these kind of like quarterly or annual kind of issues of Film Photographic Presents kind of thing. Sadly, I've just never really gotten around to seeing that through. So hopefully one day. But
yeah.
A Plain View was the first book with Film Photographic's name on it. And so that was exciting. But I'd like to do more publishing. But we've co-sponsored a handful of exhibitions, group shows, which has been great. San Francisco, Texas, LA. We want to kind of broaden that as well. That's been fun. Yeah, so it's been a good thing to do. I just want to do more with it. I just have to find the time.
The time, yeah. That seems to be... We talk about that all the time with the podcast, too. Yeah. It's like we want to do kind of like an annual zine or book or something like that with either guests or listeners, you know, kind of collage
right.
them in.
And
you
probably had that idea for like 3 years.
Yeah,
oh,
for
we have,
literally
yeah.
3 years.
Since we started,
yeah, yeah.
literally.
And it's just the time. Time is... Such a beast sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, all the time, actually.
especially when you get older.
Yeah.
Yeah. Time's not slowing down by any means.
We'll be right back with some listener questions for Jason right after this message from our sponsor.
Support for Analog Talk also comes from Polaroid Originals. Go to PolaroidOriginals.com and use the offer code AnalogTalk10 at checkout to receive 10% off your next purchase.
All right, guys, this is a part of the show where we take some questions from our listeners. This question comes from Safe Light Labs, a.k.a. Rob.
Hey, Rob.
Hi, Rob. He asks, in the digital age, how do you encourage more people to print their photos /zines/books?
Oh, geez. How do you encourage more people to print? Well, it's a good question because I think it depends on who wants to print their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? You have to want to print. And I think those that do, they find a way, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I've seen a lot of zines on Instagram, and I've received a lot of zines from film photographers that make their own zines and, you know, do print swaps. I've done print swaps with people or a print for a zine or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I guess all the people that are using iPhones and not even DSLRs, for example, I don't know that they're really interested in even printing, right? Because it's the Instagram age.
It is.
So I guess it depends on if you want to print. I guess the answer is if you want to print, you're already printing,
yeah,
I think.
You're gonna
right.
print.
I don't know if that's really the best answer, but I really do think it comes down to I don't know that many people want to print. But certainly, you know, what else would you say to that?
Well, I think the resurgence of film or like the resurgence of printing. No, let me rephrase that. The importance, not the resurgence, the importance of printing your work has been a hot topic in the last couple of years. I feel like everybody's like who's into printing work. You know what I mean? Like I'm a big I usually print 4x6s of each roll that I do. I have a really nice Canon printer, and, you know, I'll just blow the money on printing 4x6s pretty much every time I fit. Mm. I mean, I won't print the dead shots, like the shots that don't, you know, that aren't anything, but I'll usually print out like the keepers of a roll and put them in a little photo album. And I mean,
that's great. That's a, I mean,
because there's nothing better than grabbing two of my photo albums and sitting out in the porch and just, you know, listening to the birds and flipping through my photo album instead of clicking on my Instagram account on my phone or on my computer. I mean, I think it's coming back, but I think a lot of people, like you said, like iPhone photographers and stuff like that, people that aren't really doing that, they don't even know. They don't even realize.
They're
that,
not thinking. I mean, I don't know if you can push printing on somebody that printing isn't really even on their radar.
Yeah.
I think what like inspires me to print is like seeing other people's prints and like
zines
and stuff.
I mean, if you're interested in printing, there's certainly a lot to be seen on Instagram in terms of projects that people are working on. Zines are really popular, you know.
Yeah.
And another thing that I was a holdout on was digital printing, but I've embraced it because, you know, the pigment inks and the papers you can get, and, you know, that's a way to go.
Yeah, yeah.
That can be done certainly far less expensively than sort of traditional printing. I don't really know. I mean, I certainly love to print. And, you know, again, having been a holdout on that, you know, when I first started seeing samples of some of my 4x5 high-res scans digitally output on fiber-based papers with pigment inks, and I could absolutely still feel the presence of the film and see the grain. And I did a lot of comparing, too. You know, I was really, really blown away. And so certainly that's a more economical and efficient way to see your work, and you can buy printers for relatively cheap.
Yeah. Now,
you know,
yeah, nowadays, man, it's it's changed a lot.
Well, that's a good answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think Rob asked that as well, because he just opened up a photo lab where he's doing printing and like a dark
community
room.
Community dark room.
Yeah. So he's probably thinking about that a lot, owning a dark room in 2019, you know, like how do I get people to come? I mean, I feel like he's fairly successful with what he does.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's definitely regaining some popularity.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
You know,
well, we'll go on to the next one. And this question comes from Where Are We Now? At Where Are We Now on Instagram. And he says, out of all the towns/cities you visited, which one was your favorite to document?
Oh, boy.
yeah, I want to know this, too, because you've pretty much been all over the place.
Here's the interesting answer. I mean, obviously, I have a fondness for the West Coast because that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to separate that. The whole point of what I do is that it's all the same. That's really the whole point, right?
Yeah.
So the Oklahoma photographs are photographs that I happen to make in Oklahoma. But there are prints in that show that will remind somebody from Iowa of many parts of Iowa.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are parts of there are Texas photos from a plain view that look like things I've photographed years ago in California. So the whole point really of what I'm doing is it's all inclusive, really. It's all the same landscape, because you're talking about the age of development. Right. You're talking about constant progression. Right. Yeah. And what that leaves in its wake. And this is the American social landscape. It's a blanket thing. Whether you're in Pennsylvania or California, you're going to find something new next to something old.
Yeah.
You're going to find traces of things that once were that are no longer, but that are still somehow there. And they've become a part of our collective everyday view, no matter where we are. So it's this constant sort of tug of war between old and new, man and nature, and progress sort of disrupting the contented, right?
Yes.
So
yes.
A lot of the Oklahoma City stuff that I shot was from a distance. Instead of going into the heart of the city and documenting the buildings, I shot a lot of Tulsa from the outskirts, where you can see economical differences, structural differences, progress differences, architectural differences, you know, And to that's the real view of Tulsa. Mm. It's not interesting to me if I'm just sort of documenting the heart of the city.
Yeah, cherry picking the good stuff.
Because there's a reality that exists on the outside of the city, and that's a more interesting view to me to kind of show to show it from all sides, so to speak. Right. So you have this conflict and these environmental contradictions all over America.
Right.
So in terms of being on the road, yeah, I love driving up the coast and going to Big Sur or, you know, like seeing the Pacific Ocean or, you know, that's very enjoyable to me. But at the same time, I love roaming random small towns in Oklahoma. That's exciting to me. Yeah. So I don't know that I have a favorite place necessarily. I'm just excited to be on the road and to literally see what I find around each new corner. You know what I mean? As I roll into a new town somewhere that I never imagined I would be in. And that's very exciting to me. And so I kind of look at it as a continuation. You know, it's a new piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Every time I make a new exposure in some new place, it might be reminiscent of something I've shot before or similar in some way. It's sort of a continuation. It's new pieces of the puzzle, this sort of hopefully big puzzle. That's really what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
People often ask, like at the exhibition, what's your favorite photo? And I never really have an answer.
Mm.
Because
that's always a hard question.
It's tough because I don't know how to describe that. It's as tough for me as answering the question of what my favorite place is.
Mm.
Because I'm trying to look at it as much as I can as all being relatively the same.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
It's a collection rather than like a single. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a collection. And you know, We still have the same America that Walker Evans was photographing and William Christenberry was photographing and Robert Adams and Henry Wessel and, you know, the new topographics movement, or I don't know if you want to use the word movement, but the new topographics exhibition in 1975 at the George Eastman Museum. I mean, this is an exhibition that people either understood or they didn't understand.
Yeah.
But this is when we really kind of started seeing this kind of documentation of this America, you know, just as it lay, as it is, all these conflicts. And it's amazing. If you get the new topographics book, there's a transcribed interview in there that a college student did with a couple. And the man was defending the exhibition, and his girlfriend was not interested in it at all. She didn't understand. Why are these photographs? I don't understand why this should be considered photography. And I mean, this is maybe a whole other podcast. I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But I mean, you know, I'm sort of digressing here. But anyway, I think it sounds cheesy or whatever, but my favorite place, honestly, is just wherever I am when I'm there on
the
road.
That's a good answer.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I know I'm going to find something exciting, something interesting, something familiar, something new, but it's all somehow tied together going back 13 years now for me. Mm. And so the journey continues.
Mm.
Love it.
Yeah, that was
Love
great.
It.
That was a great answer.
It's a great answer. So now we have the hard questions to ask. So this is if you had to choose one camera, like your desert island, this is the last camera I could ever use, what would it be and why?
It would probably be the same Graflex 4x5 that I've been using. It's got an old 1941 uncoated Kodak Ektar 127 millimeter lens on it. It just feels like my buddy.
Yep.
You know, it's,
yep.
It's just banged up. It's been many thousands of miles and it just has a certain kind of familiarity to me and a certain smell, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that something? Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels kind of like, you know, like my dog or something, my little buddy, you know?
Love that.
I mean, I have my Leica M6 still, the very first one I bought in 2002. Of course, I'd never get rid of that, but I just like the old Graflex for some reason.
Is there anything you are lusting after, like your white whale, something you haven't shot yet, but you always wanted to?
gear wise.
Yeah.
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 No, I'm pretty low maintenance. You know, like I said, I do have the Mamiya 7.2, and that's what I used for all the medium format stuff for the Oklahoma series.
Ah, cool.
That's a great
cool.
camera with the 65 millimeter lens. But not really. I don't really get too much into gear other than kind of what I have. Yeah. I mean, I certainly would like to see more Polaroid film.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably film more than cameras, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can find cameras. The films that are going away, that's a little tougher.
Yeah.
I try not to think about it.
Yeah.
Gets me sad.
Yeah.
But that is a book recommendation, the new Topographics book.
I know that
sort of, you know, gained a lot of popularity over the years after that exhibition was essentially considered somewhat of a failure.
Really?
But it was not well received.
Hmm.
But now, of course, it's much more acceptable to go out and explore the ordinary.
Right.
You know what I mean? And just kind of, shoot photos of just what you see out there and all of these sort of contradictions. Robert Adams' The New West is a great book, too. That's 70s photos of developing Colorado. And so, of course, there's a lot of conflict there between sort of the nature that once was and this development of the New West. So I draw a lot from that sort of that approach, I guess. William Christenberry's work is great too. Also, people should read the book Why People Photograph by Robert Adams.
Oh.
He's a great writer. There's great insight there. He was a professor of English for about 7 or 8 years at UCLA before he started photographing. So the way he writes about photography is incredible. But he writes a lot about that, about the early photographers and what they were able, how they must have seen things before the evolution, so to speak, of pollution development.
Yeah.
And so that's ultimately why people maybe stop buying into the Ansel Adams thing, because outside of his very beautiful documentations of Yosemite, there was a shitty landscape of litter and garbage and strip malls forms varying degrees of degradation. And eventually people stopped caring so much about architecture and style and design, and things just start popping up, and we are now a shopping mall country. And
true.
So when that early photography started surfacing, documenting this kind of shopping mall America and these weird contrasts between sort of the old and the new, and basically what man is doing to the landscape, that's more the reality. I mean, and what Ansel Adams did is certainly gorgeous.
Yeah.
You know, but I think for certain people, it became more interesting to see, well, what do you see outside of that view? And what do you see on your way to Yosemite?
Right.
You know, what is this real kind of America out here? Yeah. And what's happening with this landscape? So, yeah, I early on, I found myself being kind of interested in Christenberry's stuff and Joel Sternfeld's book, American Prospects, was one that I had kind of early on. And then the Robert Adams stuff, Walker Evans, and then Eugene Atget in Paris. You know, he was shooting buildings in Paris. He was shooting this sort of ordinary everyday views of Paris, back alleys. And, you know, it wasn't pretty pictures of the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
It was cracked cobblestone roads and cracked buildings. And it was, you know, just whatever it was, just everyday views. So I think you could sort of trace it back to Atget, and then Walker Evans is a noted kind of influence on a lot of the American photographers that kind of started going out and just kind of shooting these kind of ordinary everyday scenes that are very much a part of our view of the landscape.
Mm.
Just some recommendations there.
Yeah, no, I love that.
Sorry if I went on a little
no.
too long.
No, no. I just made a list of things I got to do this.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll make sure to leave some links to these books in the show notes and stuff to you guys, just so you can check it out. for sure.
Yeah, Why People Photograph is a really important book to read.
I've been recommended that too before.
Yeah, it's really great.
I need to get my hands on that.
Check it out. Me too. All right. Well, Jason, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This has been awesome chatting with you. We really appreciate you taking the time. Where can everybody check out your work?
JasonLeeFilm.com and then Instagram when I'm on it. Like I think most humans, I have a love-hate relationship with Instagram at this point. But and then, you know, if anybody feels inclined to take a road trip, I've got my work up in Tulsa right now at Philbrook. But I'm so honored. Thank you so much for this. I love talking about photography. I could keep going on, but I don't want to take up any more of your time. I really appreciate it. And thank you guys so much. It was nice to meet you over this this technology here.
Yeah, the future.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is. It's crazy.
All right, guys, first off, we want to thank Jason Lee. Jason, thanks so much for being on the show. We had such a good time. It was, again, like we said at the beginning, it was just such a great time getting to hear your story and your insight on photography. You had some great answers. We had some fun laughs. It was just a really, really fun time. Thanks again. Also, guys, that brings us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. We have a bunch of little tiers over there. Any little bit of support helps the show, helps us free up some extra time from our busy work schedules to produce this show and get guests on and all that fun stuff. You know, we have some benefits over there, some print giveaways, some live streams, some after show stuff. So check it out. For all the Patreons already that help support the show, guys, thank you so much. Your support means the absolute world to us. Also, one last favor to ask. Take 1 second if you have the time. Head over to iTunes, subscribe to Analog Talk. Leave a little review and a comment. All that stuff kind of helps boost the show and puts it in, you know, puts it in the eyes of other people interested in film photography and hearing, you know, from all these different guests and stuff like that. So thanks so much for all the support, guys. We are actually going to be taking a couple weeks off. Chris is in Israel right now on a little vacation, so it'll be about 2 or 3 weeks until we get back to you guys. So enjoy your summer, and we'll see you soon. Later.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.